Well, the last time you were here, it was on the occasion of the Innocents.
That's right. Not so long ago.
No, it wasn't a couple. When was that exactly? 2 years ago?
2 years ago, yeah.
Yes, I have all my notes.
Yep.
Dated on a computer, or dated July 26, 1990.
I was wondering when it was. But
it's not when we did the interview, but when I
made
my notes from the interview and cut the tape.
Right.
So, that was a wonderful novel.
We've just finished making the movie.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Who's going to be in it?
Anthony Hopkins and Isabella Rossellini and a marvelous younger American actor who plays the young Englishman called Campbell Scott.
Who's the director?
John Schlesinger is the director.
And you wrote the screenplay?
I wrote the screenplay, and we're just finishing up in post-production. And I guess we will deliver it in mid-January, and the movie will then be in the hands of whoever distributes it here, probably Paramount. So,
well, with John Schlesinger and Anthony Hopkins, it should be a very intelligent film.
It looks great, and it's very pacey, beautifully done, wonderful cast. I mean, I have to say, we have a Welshman playing an American, we have a Swedish Italian playing a German, and we have an American playing an Englishman. So it's a real sort of babel of accents, but it seems to work.
Filmed, I assume, on location.
Yeah, we rebuilt the Berlin Wall in order to have the couple meet at the wall as it's coming down. So we had a crowd of 600 cheering and waving flags.
As you put the wall up?
Yeah. I have a feeling the residents rather wanted us to leave it up.
Well, what about the tunnel? Does that the original tunnel remain?
Well, you can go to the site and see where the bits of it, the tunnel itself was collapsed. Soon after the Russians discovered it, we built a tunnel in the old DAFA studios, the studios where Blue Angel was made and where the Nazis made their propaganda films and where the East Germans made very grand children's movies during the 50s and 60s. And built the tunnel in sections, mostly based on photographs.
I assume you're going to handle the dismemberment scene tastefully.
Some tact. So we want a general kind of classification for release. And it's done just as it's about to begin. You cut suddenly to the everyday life in the courtyard below. But with a music score that gives a feeling of threat. And then you come suddenly back in on the aftermath. And it's actually quite powerful, I think.
Are you a movie buff?
Yep. Writing movies has been my other life.
What other films have you written?
Well, we're just about to start shooting a movie with Macaulay Culkin. Next week, in fact, with 20th Century Fox. A movie I wrote about 5 years ago called The Good Son.
A Good Son.
Yeah.
So it's an original screenplay.
Yeah.
Not adapted from any book.
No, it's an original. I wrote a film which you may or may not have heard of. I had a very nice run in the art houses here in New York about 10 years ago called The Plowman's Lunch.
What is it called?
The Plowman's Lunch, it was called.
No, I'm not familiar with
it. It was a sort of political film about the Falklands War and the Suez Crisis, of this rather intercut. Another movie was called Sour Sweet, which was an all-Chinese cast, based on a novel by Timothy Moe. Had one of these movies that it got lovely notices, but it disappeared without a trace in 10 days, just through some scheduling mistake. And I always regret that one, because it all worked out much as we all hoped it would. But come release day, I don't know, it got edged out by something else in the distributor's schedule, and it was gone.
Say, while you're here, I know you came to see the Matisse, but have you ever been to the Astoria Film Studios in Queens?
No, I haven't.
I was there for the first time.
Oh, wait a minute. Yes, hold on. Yeah, go ahead.
I was there for the first time just a few weeks ago, and it It is probably the first, or one of the first film studios in America. And it occupies blocks and blocks and blocks. And you can't go into a lot of the buildings because they actually do make movies there. Mm. But one of the buildings has a film museum, which is well worth seeing. Well, and it's easy to get there by subway or by taxi. It's relatively close. It's in an area, in a heavily Greek area called Astoria. Lots of Greek restaurants and shops and things. But the film studio is well worth seeing. You can spend 2, 3, 4 hours there. All sorts of exhibits and old equipment, old cameras. They change. It changes constantly. Costumes and makeup. And so it might be worth spending an afternoon. It opens at noon, I believe.
See a bit of New York one would never usually see.
Well, it's in a very modest middle-class neighborhood. In fact, it looks like very low. It looks like much of London looks like, in fact. Not a bad neighborhood, but it's not a well-to-do neighborhood at all. But all of a sudden, you go through this rather plain, ordinary neighborhood, and you see these immense buildings stretching for blocks. It must be maybe 3 or 4 blocks of buildings.
Right. Well, it is worth check that.
If you're a film buff, it might be worth stopping in.
Yeah. I think I went out there once. I was taken out there to watch Michael Caine and a movie called Death Trap. I think that must be the same studio because it was a big, big place. And there can't be many film studios in New York these days.
Well, there are a number of film studios, but this is a major one that was in effect in the 1920s. And it is still in use, but it's now a National Historic Landmark as well. But now they have a very active museum, which they didn't have before, so it might be worth stopping in.
Sure.
Well, we're here to talk about Black Dogs, which is certainly a worthy follow-up to The Innocent. Tell me how you got the idea for this book.
Well, it began in a rather strange way. I was walking in the countryside in southern France with a friend. We were in a very desolate bit of landscape. There'd been a forest fire a few years before. It was very high up, just black stumps all around. The weather had suddenly turned nasty. And we came around a bend in the path, and ahead of us were two of the largest dogs I've ever seen in my life, just standing in the path about 50 yards away. Black, no collars. The nearest village was 12 miles away. And we stopped and decided that we wouldn't approach them. We circled round them, and actually they gave us no trouble. They trotted off down the path, and we never saw them again. But that first moment of fear, I kept returning to. I was very interested in the way that almost immediately I was no longer looking at dogs. I was looking at symbols or emblems or feeling that they stood for something. And I began to think about how a character might make use of such a moment, especially if the dogs were a little more threatening. And began to think about what we mean by a turning point in a life, or how suddenly someone might reverse a whole set of opinions and ideas. And that really was the beginning of the story of this young woman who's an ardent, committed communist, coming to go off in a completely different direction, spend her life in meditation and committing herself to religious and spiritual beliefs because she has what she regards as an encounter with evil, and through that some kind of notion of the Godhead. And then for a long time I've been wanting to write a novel of ideas. Sounds a bit off-putting, but I guess in a sense that's what it was, in which the scientific and the rational could be set against the intuitive and the spiritual. And I saw that the best way to do this would be within a marriage, to do it locally, in microcosm, not as a set of ideas, but as two characters. And that's how the novel really takes shape, of the story of a marriage in the post-war years between two characters who, once they go on their separate ways, he to rational political reform and her to her own spiritual pursuits, can never really be together, but nor can they ever quite let each other alone. They live separately, but they can never quite divorce.
These characters are the father and mother-in-laws of the narrator. It's interesting, I can't remember the names. Bernard and the...
June. This is his wife.
I have a terrible time remembering names in books.
Sure.
But June has this encounter with, as you put it, evil, or maybe even death, because I think she could also see her own vulnerability when these horribly vicious dogs, the product of the Gestapo in southern France, appear. And so her life does change. She may not recognize it, or maybe she does, because I think at that point she buys a little farmhouse.
That's right.
And she does this on her own, independent of her husband. So she changes, but he never does he? His essential philosophy, his ideas, his ardent belief in social reform never alters, does it?
No, he holds faith with that notion, which I think many of us would commit ourselves to, that the world can only improve if serious, responsible people take rational thought and try to make better laws, better ways of doing things, more just, more equitable means of sharing wealth and organizing our society. He ceases to become a communist, but works for the Labour Party, becomes rather famous.
And in fact goes to celebrate the end of the Berlin Wall.
That's right, takes the narrator with him in 1989 to celebrate the end of the wall. And yes, I mean, he does remain committed to a rational view that however chaotic and cruel the world is, our only hope is to take rational thought and try and make it better. June takes a very different view. Her idea is that no amount of laws, no amount of careful planning will ever make a jot of difference unless we do something about ourselves. That we have to really, the great problem is the human heart, and that there'll always be cruelty and injustice until we spend more time directing ourselves to ourselves. Bernard thinks this is a kind of daft and romantic view. She thinks that his is a rather cold and ridiculous view, and they can never really quite talk to each other. They're very impatient.
There is an American phrase that might be applied to June's feeling, and I'm not sure it's accurate, but I have a feeling it is. It's called copping out. June cops out.
This would be Bernard's view, yes.
Well, it's also my view, because in removing herself to isolation and mysticism, she's not really making, although she does write a little book about her philosophy and so forth, she's not really making the kind of contribution Bernard does.
No, she would argue that what she does is what everyone has to do sooner or later, and that only by more and more people doing this will society change organically, not driven by ideas, but just by the organic changes within a society when more and more people come to value the kinds of things she does. Now, Jeremy, the narrator, is a man who rather slides between the two. When he's with Bernard, he rather favours June, and when he's with June, he can't help reaching for his own scepticism, and is often frequently embarrassed by June's protestations about the Godhead and so on. It's not a novel that tells you how to live. It's simply one that will provide the questions.
For which we're vastly appreciative. There are plenty of people telling us how to live. Including June.
Exactly, and including Bernard, too.
You're right.
I rather think the novel is more of an investigative form, really, rather than, didacticism, moral preaching generally is the death of anything lively happening on the page. And that's why the narrator is someone who, right from the start, is confesses himself to be someone who's always pursued other people's parents. His own died when he was very young. And even as a teenager, he was always getting his foot in the door of other people's parents' houses and hanging around with his elders when his contemporaries were out doing all the crazy things that teenagers are meant to do. So there's a kind of longing in this memoir. He wants to claim these parents-in-law for himself. And the rational side of Bernard and the spiritual side of June sort of contest. They really are the extremes, the poles, the polar points between which he slips and slides.
There's a wonderful, vivid scene set in Berlin that made me feel as though you must have been an eyewitness yourself.
Well, I was. As soon as the wall came down, my wife and I hopped on a plane. Berlin had come to mean a lot to me through the writing of The Innocent, so in a way these novels rather overlap. I'd already finished The Innocent by then. We went along and saw the wall come down at Potsdamer Platz and generally took part in the 2 or 3 day long street party in Berlin. And all that joyousness and relief now seems a little innocent, for want of a better word. No one can, of course, regret that those grey tyrannies have come to an end, but what's unleashed, I suppose, is not only freedom, but freedom to be bad. Certain very nasty elements of European civilization were kind of held in a deep freeze.
Well, that's easily explained. You know, when you have a police state, you can certainly keep your society under control.
Exactly.
When you don't have a police state and people are allowed to do pretty much what they want to, as you described, they do have the option of being bad.
Exactly. And now we see those old specters returning: anti-Semitism, various forms of extreme right-wing movements, old ethnic rivalries, very unpleasant forms of nationalism, old border disputes that were set in aspic for 40 years now are being relived. And I suppose this novel is about one character's attempt to find a means of describing this revival in terms of these black dogs, which for June symbolize evil. They were left behind by the Gestapo at the end of the war. She imagines them in her dreams, galloping off across this landscape into the grey of the dawn to reappear somewhere else in Europe. I suppose where they have reappeared already is in what was once called Yugoslavia, and certainly too in places like Rostock in Germany. This is really what June means by black dogs. An idea, by the way, which she borrowed from Churchill. Churchill used to call his depressions the black dog. In fact, since writing the book, I've come across numerous references in classical literature as well as older European literature to the black dog, either as melancholy or evil. And I realised that I was probably quite unconsciously being driven by a kind of archetype here. They really are the archetype of evil in many medieval woodcuts. You see it. There's a dog at the feet of Dürer's Melancholia. Horace refers to the black dogs as the very form of evil. And there are many accounts in ghost stories of people meeting the devil in the form of a black dog, especially by churchyards. All of this I discovered after the event with a sort of mild pleasure, really, to feel that these things are. Well, this is the penumbra that surrounds these things.
Well, they make a great metaphor, there's no question about that. To go back to what we touched on before about societal changes in the police state. I assume this is the case in England as well, because there's an upheaval almost every place. In this country, people complain all the time about changes in society and how it's broken down and how there's violence. And I was thinking that I grew up in the 40s and 50s, and you didn't think of the United States as being a police state, but it was in many respects. For example, there was certainly censorship. Our films were censored. Our books were censored.
Mm-hmm.
There was being the product of Victorians. There was a lot of uneasiness about sex, and there was a crackdown on nudity. The police were not as inhibited as they are today.
Mm-hmm.
There was such a thing as what they called the third degree. Police brutality was understood. Police were in control. And people don't believe that now. I mean, there are all sorts of... for example, a police civilian review board would not have been thought of in the 1930s.
Sure.
And people were kept in line, kept in control. And by the 60s, with the advent of the Beatles and this sort of thing, things began to change. And people wanted more of these freedoms, and they wanted nudity, and they wanted to be able to take drugs. And there did become a kind of a breakdown, and people don't like it. But then, and I'm sure this is the way it is in England, too, to a degree, maybe not as extreme as here, because England does have slightly more repressive laws than this country. But at the same time, while we don't like what's happening, you have to ask yourself, which freedoms do you want to give up first? Could we ever go back to the 40s, the 50s, or the period when there was more repression in society?
I think it's almost impossible, even if you decided you wanted to do it. I don't know how you could arrange it once people start to assume certain kinds of freedoms. And these freedoms weren't only the freedom, say, to take drugs, but they're also the freedom of women to do things that men traditionally frowned upon them doing, like read the news or have full lives and as professionals. Various other kinds of freedoms that I don't think we could ever really want to give up now. And I think you have to take it all together. I mean, I think it is immensely difficult and painful. But I don't... I always think that when I hear a politician calling for a return to some moment in the past when things were better, my first feeling is that some sorry illusion is being pursued. You can never get back. B, the past was never quite as tidy and as pleasant as anyone pretends. We've had this during the 80s with politicians calling for a return to Victorian standards. Well, the Victorians had many positive attributes, but they also had some appalling ones, too. And,
isn't that exactly what happened during the presidential campaign in this country?
Mm.
That's what the campaign of the Republicans was, return to family values, which was exactly what you said, a return to Victorian values.
Mm.
Not going to happen.
No. And family values, I mean, I don't think, it's such a nebulous term. I mean, we all love our families, but that doesn't mean to say we all have exactly the same ideas of what a family value is. I mean, I think these vague terms are very useful for politicians. They create a sort of little tug on the heartstring, but I don't think it adds up to a hill of beans, as Humphrey Bogart would say, in terms of a social policy.
I think the voters in this past presidential election in the U.S. would agree with you.
Well, yes, by 6%. Not by a vast majority, but yes. Interesting to see what's going to happen here. It'll have a profound effect on Britain, the change in political culture here. No one seems to have their hopes too high, because people have been disappointed in the past by what politicians can achieve. But I think there's a general feeling I get here of sort of fingers crossed and a certain amount of goodwill that things will work out for Clinton.
The situation is the same in Europe, where you describe the fall of the wall, but then what you're also describing is a period in which people have to take greater responsibilities for their own lives. because they're not going to be regulated by the state to the degree they were.
Yes, well, not only that, but they also find themselves out of work, and with, in many cases, less food than they had before.
It's a changeover in economies, yeah. And it's an upheaval right now.
Whether this is simply the painful moment of transition, which is how everybody felt it was, say, a year or two ago, or whether this is the beginning of some sort of appalling decline, say, for everyday Russians, is now being called into question.
No, it's going to improve for the Russians, but it's going to take time. I was reading in the Times some time ago that big businesses were planning major investments in the Soviet Union, which is going to result in jobs. There are whole markets there that are yet to be tapped. In fact, already the largest McDonald's in the world is in Moscow. So it eventually will improve, but it's not going to happen overnight.
No. I think that for ordinary Russians, rather than for us in the West, the question is, will it improve? I think people are beginning to get a little anxious that things are spinning out of control.
There's a wonderful book by Martin Cruz Smith that just came out called Red Square.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you read it. It's kind of a thriller. He has a Soviet homicide detective called Arkady Rimko.
He's the one who wrote Gorky Park.
That's correct.
Yeah, I remember.
And he went back, and what he has done, he's one of the first fiction writers to describe what's going on there now as it applies to everyday people, where the black market is extreme, where you can buy almost anything you want on the black market at vastly inflated prices, whereas the major department stores are empty.
Yeah.
And what an interesting life. In order to get a bottle of vodka, because they're trying to crack down on drunkenness there, you must bring back an empty bottle.
Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting from Cruz Smith's point of view, because I think Gorky Park was written from the sort of Los Angeles Public Library or wherever he was.
He went there for a week.
A week, yeah. I admire writers for that. I like that. I prefer that.
He had, but since that time, I mean, he's been back a number of times, now has a bank account there, and he's been treated as a hero. The last time he went there, he was taken around by detectives, and so he did an enormous amount of research. And this novel is set in Frankfurt, I believe, either Frankfurt or Munich now, I can't remember, in Berlin, as well as Moscow. So he was there. He really did his research for this one.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing about it is not so much the plot, but just the descriptions of what is going on in a fictional way.
Mm. Well, I'd be interested as a writer to see... I thought that Gorky Park had such a wonderful feel of Moscow and gave you the illusion that he knew that police department. So I'd be interested to see what the difference is between doing research at a distance and then seeing the real thing, whether he's sharpened that or whether research has bogged him down as it can.
I believe he has. He also wrote a second one based on his character, but this was not set in the Soviet Union, but on a, I'm going to call it a fishing boat. It's a like, fishing processing boat of some kind in the North Sea, not the North Sea. What's the sea off of Alaska? I can't remember. The Bering Sea, off the Bering Sea, but he actually he had problems with this one. I don't want to digress because we're here to talk about you, but he had problems, and he made arrangements to go on a Russian fishing boat, and he was able to get on it briefly, and then the captain was told that he had written an anti-communist book or anti-Soviet book in Gorky Park.
Mm-hmm.
And they threw him off. He spent the next week on a U.S. trawler, in which he got a lot of atmosphere, but he didn't have a lot of information about the Soviet fishing boat. I don't want to call it a fishing boat because it's not. It's an enormous ship in which other trawlers and fishing boats bring their fish
right,
to be
processed.
Right,
it's a fish factory.
Yeah, it's a factory ship.
Yep.
But it worked out nicely. But this third one is the best of all, it's what's one thing to read a journalistic report of what's happening. It's another thing to read a fictional report by a good fiction writer, because that way you get into the hearts and minds of people and you describe what's really going on. And his is one of the first to do it.
I'll look out for it.
I'm sorry?
I'll look out for it.
Yeah. Well, tell me just, we're almost out of time, or we're actually out of time, but just tell me a little bit about your everyday life. You're living in London, right?
No, I live in Oxford with my wife, and we have two grown-up children who are now at college, and two little children of 9 and 6.
That's right. I believe you told me you have a large Victorian-style house.
We have a large Victorian house. I work at home, around the quiet side of the house. I'm a fairly disciplined writer, I think. Once I've got something on the go, I usually arrange to walk one or both of the children to school to get the day going, and then sit down to work with the coffee that I'm always trying to give up by about 9 o'clock.
You have the Oxford Library facilities to help you if you need something.
Well, the lovely thing about living in Oxford is if ever you want to find something out in a very small space, there are a lot of people who can point you to the right books or tell you at first hand what you want to know.
I was going to say, you have a battery of experts there.
Yeah, and they're always very willing to help. Had a lot of help from The Innocent, from a pathologist. Used one or two journalist friends to... or writer friends who are experts on Poland and, to help with little bits of Black Dogs. And also some very good readers, very tight, sceptical, unfriendly, and very useful friends who will sit down with your typescript and not feel any constraints about telling you if they don't like it or what they do like and what they don't. And I value that a great deal from my friends in Oxford.
Well, Black Dogs, another beautiful book by Ian McEwan. Ian, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.